gentlemen, to the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go freaking nuts. And we're broadcasting live from the very special, fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which according to the Prime Minister John Key is good for the economy, because now everybody by proxy has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is known only as Nigel, and he's, well, and also there's this other, and by the way, I love the name Nigel, because of Nigel Farage, the UK Independence Party, calling the secretary of the EU Parliament a damp rag of some sort. So I've always had an affinity for the name Nigel ever since that moment. Well, welcome to the program, mate.
Ah, thanks, Benny. Yeah, I do actually have a surname. It's Waddington.
Right.
So Nigel Waddington, it's a frightfully British name, old boy.
Yeah.
Even if I have lived in Australia all my life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why don't you elucidate on your local Aussie culture and then, you know, let us know who you are and what you do, because it's Anzac Day today.
Oh, yeah. Elucidate on the local Aussie culture. Oh, God, Lord, I'm beginning with something like that.
Well, let me see if I can sum it up for you. A desert surrounded by alcoholics.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't drink that much alcohol, actually. But, yeah, there is that that element of Australian culture.
So you're the desert.
Could be looked at that way.
All right, the one sober man in a half-cut country. And over here, Anzac Day is all over. Like, it's a big New Zealand thing. I don't know how it is in Australia, bro, but it's all over the radio. You know, loving it. All the elderly calling in, talking about their brothers and their uncles and such like that fought in the war, and also mentioning that they never frickin' talk about it. You know why they never frickin' talk about it, don't you? Because if you talk about something, it's like reliving it. And who the hell wants to relive going through that kind of stuff?
Yes. Yeah. The unfortunate thing is that, with maybe a few rare exceptions, the Australian military has never actually been used to defend Australia itself. Tends to get used by the major powers to, you know, fight in skirmishes in various parts of the world. Although it does have to be said that, you know, some of those operations are relatively benign, like the operation in East Timor. Well, I say relatively benign. And certainly having known a number of people who are in the military, most people I've met in the Australian military are pretty decent.
Nigel, you've got to speak up a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, unfortunately I don't have a direct microphone, so can you hear me properly now?
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, when you trail off and stuff like that, we can't hear the rest of it. Have you noticed as well, because this is the other thing that I've seen with the so-called Anzac spirit, is it gave us both national identities, didn't it? Really?
Yeah, well, New Zealand was originally supposed to be part of Australia. Like, if you actually look at the preamble to the Australian Constitution, it includes New Zealand. New Zealand was going to be one of the states. Now, I'm not sure what happened. I haven't looked into the history of it in detail, but... I think it might have been, you know, Australian mainland politicians making a fuss that prevented that from happening. But, I'm not. That's a bit of history I will have to research sometime.
Mm. Well, yeah. Apparently, it was one of the articles of the Constitution that New Zealand would be what's it called, the seventh state of Australia, and for all intents and purposes, still is. And New Zealanders and Australians, they traverse back and forth and things like that. Not a whole lot of visas and things of that nature really need to be applied for. It's pretty close-knit. Unfortunately, if New Zealanders come over there and don't get a job, they become homeless because they can't get access to any benefits. Which is fair enough, I guess. You know, you don't want foreigners coming into your country and then not working and suddenly getting all the benefits of the state without ever having paid tax for it. But then again, some of these other people, this was on the news a couple of nights ago, I think. Our guys have been working there for years, you know, in good, decent jobs, paying their taxes. And then when they lose their job and they only need like a month or two's living expenses so they can find another one, they're homeless, mate. And they can't be employed because, you know, who wants to go into a job interview unshaven, smelly and wearing rags?
Yeah. So you're asking, what the sort of thing we're going to discuss today?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, my background, I guess, I mean, a lot of people who come in and talk about the so-called New World Order or whatever you want to call it will say, oh, you know, I was, you know, very high up in this organisation and I did this or blah, 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 blah. Well, no, I don't have any of that. I'm just simply an independent person who occasionally does some research and stumbles across things. And talked about it. And, yeah, no, so I'm not like a famous name or anything of that nature. And one of my interests, one of my many interests, is the politics, or what I call the politrics, surrounding events in the Middle East. And also, within the so-called truth movement, I've probably got to stop using that term because I'm actually seriously wondering whether there's even really any such thing as a truth movement. Is the deployment
of didn't we have a conversation about this earlier and I dubbed it the half truth movement?
Yeah, but a half truth could be said to be a whole lie, and that would probably be an appropriate description for it because the so-called truth movement is so flooded with propaganda coming from outfits such as the CIA and all different kinds of propaganda on all sorts of different issues, but one of the ones that's of particular interest to me is the deployment of anti-Zionist and sometimes outright anti-Semitic propaganda. We've now even got to the point where, like on email lists I'm on, there are people who are not only saying that the Nazi Holocaust, you know, didn't happen, right? There are now people starting to say that, oh, Hitler wasn't such a bad guy because he stood up to the Jewish bankers. So, you know, it's absolute nonsense. And what's the real concern is that so many people in the so-called truth movement are tolerating this.
There's a lot of belief out there, and despite the fact that the truth movement prides itself on being people who base their decisions on facts, evidence, that kind of thing, it's just simply not the case, and it's actually mostly done on belief. Most of the facts and things of that nature that we're going off quoting all the time, we've never actually done the background research on, don't actually know. And so you have to ask yourself, it's the old tale, I think. What was his name? The guy who wrote Tom Sawyer.
Mark Twain?
Mark Twain, yeah. Now, he says, when an honest man is confronted with the truth that he's wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
That's exactly right. And one of the problems is with... I'll call it the truth movement for now, just because people kind of know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, we've got to come up with a new term. It's an entertainment movement. It's full of entertainment junkies. And it is so flooded with, you know, information, quote-unquote, that there's no way that most people can really check all their facts. And they just start to believe them. So, I mean, I've made a point of not looking into the Boston bombings so far. But, you know, already it's just... Yeah, as it's predicted, as soon as I heard on the mainstream news that there'd been this bombing in Boston, I thought, oh, God. I knew straight away there are going to be people who will say that it didn't happen, it was all actors. I knew there were people who were going to automatically say it's a false flag. I knew that there were going to be people who were going to say that there's a terrorist drill happening at the same time, and I knew all of these things were going to come out.
You know what I knew? Now, I knew there'd be some people who say, I'm not really going to say anything until the facts come out. Like Suzanne Posel at Occupy Corporatism, that's what she said to me when I asked her about it.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to say anything substantive about it until the facts come out. For the simple fact, I don't know. And it seems to me like the theme, for example, of terrorist drills happening at the same time as actual terrorist events, it's like it's a common meme that is deployed every time there's some sort of terrorist attack. That's not to say that it's not true, but it's got to be questionable. It's almost as though, you know, there's these prepackaged themes ready to go whenever these various events happen, because they've basically painted the target audience or different target audiences, and they know exactly what sort of memes, therefore what sort of propaganda to throw at them to direct them down whatever garden path they want to direct them down.
You know, this reminds me of telemarketers. When you ask them certain questions, they've got a list. They've got a script of a list of responses to, you know, each of the questions and things like that. So when everybody says, "Oh, it might be a false flag," again, like you say, they just go to the script. Ah, here we go. There's something that we've said before 100 times on mainstream news that seemed to quiet everybody down. How about that?
Yeah, and also standard replies for the so-called alternative media. I mean, listening to some of the muckraking radio from America from the 1980s was a vastly superior quality to what we've got now. It would seem to me that the COINTELPRO or whatever name they call the operation these days, but to the same effect, injecting counterintelligence or pro-stupidity into the general public in various ways, has been quite successful in dumbing down the resistance to what I call the globalist criminal syndicate.
Distracting them, in other words, from the proper objective, which is to indeed overthrow the globalists and stop their tyranny from being put in place and exterminating everybody. Is that about right?
Well, more or less. Certainly standing up to the tyranny. And, distraction is certainly a part of it, but also a lot of it's deception, decoys, diverting people's attention onto decoys. Various agendas are served by it. But my particular interest is the role of anti-Semitic and the more politically correct version, anti-Zionist propaganda into the so-called truth movement. And not just the truth movement. Pretty much across the political spectrum, there's an anti-Zionist theme for just about every mindset.
Well, how could you actually explain that? Hold on, let me make a point as well. Distraction and entertainment you were talking about, and that's what a lot of the movement has become. I sort of noticed that I was doing that early before I started, you know, making the videos and the radio shows and all of that kind of thing. I realized that just watching and consuming everybody else's content and never going out and making any of my own to contribute, that I was simply being distracted from participating through the entertainment value of what I was watching, what I was listening to. And now I'm trying to entertain and distract people myself.
Well, that's a paradox. I don't have a simple answer for it. I mean, I haven't actually personally made a YouTube video for a couple of years now, though I do plan on getting back into it very soon. I guess the idea is your intent to distract people, quote unquote, beyond entertainment. There's nothing wrong with entertainment either. There's nothing worse than watching you know, so-called conspiracy videos that are really badly made and are really boring. So there's nothing wrong with entertainment per se. I guess the problem is when it becomes amusement. And apparently the etymology of the word...
I'm really stiffening it now.
No, amusement.
Muse. Yeah, I know.
You're
talking to Aslan.
The etymology of the word amusement, we've got muse, which is to think, amuse, which is to not think, and ment, process. So amusement is the process of not thinking.
How interesting. Well, that's a good place to leave the show on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you are amused by the Vinnie Eastwood show anyway. But please, keep thinking about how much it actually is good to deal with nasty stuff that's going on in your life by having a few laughs about it and getting over it and getting out there again. We'll be right back after the break.
I got some so-called friends. Smile right to my face. All when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Who's that? Are you?
Welcome back. Whose side are you on, ladies and gentlemen? Are you the side that will admit when you're wrong and just go, hey, you know what? I was wrong, and all those previous things that I've said suddenly just don't apply anymore. And I'm going to start now talking about what I found out was the truth. Or are you one of the people who would defend how wrong you are and try to be an apologist for it and keep spreading the disinfo anyway? Pick a side. My very special guest is Nigel Waddington. Nigel, welcome back.
Hey, Vinny, how you doing?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Yes, it is about admitting when one's mistaken and moving on. As I found out, well, quite a few years ago now, back in the days when I was an anti-Zionist myself. And to cut a long story short, I would have gone down the anti-Zionist path in about 1989, 1990. For those old enough to remember, this was shortly after the so-called First Intifada, which appeared on mainstream news and so on. And at that time, I had a sister who was overseas, and among the many things she did was go and work on a moshav in Israel. A moshav is a bit like a kibbutz, but a more commercial version of it. Anyway, she came back.
I don't have any idea what a kibbutz actually is.
Oh, right. Well, without going into laborious detail, it's basically sort of like a communal farm. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah. All righto.
And not just farms. Sometimes it's, you know, factories and things like that as well. But anyway, she came back from overseas, and you know, she'd been to Israel and asked her, you know, what's going on over there. And he was basically coming out with what I call, you know, standard Zionist platitudes. That, the Israelis, the Jews, they've been so persecuted, and they came here and they built up the land and so on and so forth. And all of which is actually quite true, but it is, when put like that, essentially little more than a platitude. And she also went on to say, and the Arabs are somewhat underdogs, but you can't give them too much, but they'll take too much. Da, da, da. Now, none of this particularly impressed me very much, because it was a similar sort of theme to that which Australian racists would say about what some people call the Australian Aboriginals, or the original inhabitants of this land. The same sort of thing. But none of that really impressed me too much. And then I ended up getting my hands on a book put out by this mob called the International Socialist Organization. It was called Israel, the Hijacked State. And the International Socialist Organization purports not to be anti-Semitic. In fact, they're very strongly anti-Nazi and so on and so forth. But I didn't pick it up at the time, but in retrospect, looking at the picture they had on the front of their book was a very anti-Semitic theme. It had a picture of Uncle Sam struggling to hold back like this snarling bulldog with a Star of David on it. In other words, it was giving a subliminal message that Israel is this crazy state that even the big bad imperialist United States has trouble keeping under control. And and I read this book and basically went down the anti-Zionist path. And of course, I was I was into a lot of the work of Noam Chomsky at the time too. So I read his works on it and so on and so forth. All of this
we have we have a garden Noam Chomsky in our backyard.
Yeah, well, he'd be more useful to humanity as a garden gnome, I think. And I say that as someone who really used to admire him. These days I'm actually, pretty much convinced that he's working for US counterintelligence, but that's a whole other story. But one of the things that really started to turn me around was, in the wake of the 9/11 attack, and I saw, on the day of that attack, or it was Nike, I was trying to watch Star Trek and turned on to find the Klingons had flown to the World Trade Center. And I knew that there was something wrong about it. I knew they were going to blame Osama bin Laden, and I knew they were going to invade Afghanistan. And the reason I knew that wasn't because I was, some great prophet, but because not all that long earlier, I've been reading articles about how there were plans for the US to make moves into Central Asia. And I remember when I was reading those articles, I thought, I wonder what sort of excuse they're going to need for that, and all of a sudden this happened. So I kind of knew that was what the results were going to be. And I thought there's something wrong about this whole 9/11 thing, the way it's playing out. I couldn't put my finger on it. But shortly in the wake of it, as more and more facts and details start to come out, one of the themes that started to come out was the notion that the Israelis were behind 9/11. And there was talk about, you may have heard the story about the dancing Israelis and
outside 9/11 they had like a film camera and they were dancing around celebrating when the towers got hit.
Yeah, that's how the story goes, yes. A very strange thing for people who just pulled off the biggest terrorist attack in history to be doing, really, to be filming it from a distance and dancing. And it's also very funny, that story about how supposedly bomb-sniffing dogs sniff their bands and smell traces of explosives when, for a start, as a lot of evidence now shows, it wasn't a controlled demolition per se. It was something else. Dr. Booty would call it the directed energy weapon. Whatever one wants to call it, the effects of the 9/11 attack are not consistent with either plane crashes and fuel weakening the steel or with controlled demolition. So the whole question about explosives is exactly that, a question. But furthermore, if explosives were used, it would seem a bit strange that people would be driving around with explosives tainted bands on the morning of the attack. So, there's a whole heap of weird anomalies, right? But this notion that the Israelis pulled off 9/11 was gaining traction. And I also was noticing on a lot of forums that anti-Zionists, and I was still an anti-Zionist at the time, were saying all sorts of outrageous things. And I thought, hang on, what's going on here? And then in 2002, there was the so-called Jenin massacre. This was supposedly the Israeli military had gone into the Jenin refugee camp and massacred, 500 plus Palestinian civilians. Right? And this was on the mainstream news. And I remember at the time, I was under the impression that the Western media was pro-Israel. So I thought, if even the Western media is saying this, probably even worse. And then all of a sudden, the facts came out that it wasn't a massacre at all, it was a fight involving the death of about 56 Palestinians, most of whom were involved in fighting, so they weren't defenseless civilians, and something like 23 Israeli soldiers. So I thought, hang on, How did that get turned into an absolute massacre? You know, and by the mainstream media, no less. That's when I started looking into things a bit further and finding that almost everything I'd believed about Israel and Zionism and the relationship between, for example, the United States and Israel, were wrong. And the effect of having this faulty intelligence, if you like, this counterintelligence, is to create absurdities within one's mind. And I've forgotten who it was who said this, but they were correct, that anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And that, I would say, is one of the key purposes, overarching purposes, behind the counterintelligence movement's injection of anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic themes and memes into not just the so-called truth movement, but pretty much across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Questions, Vinny?
No, just keep going.
Oh, well, there are so many directions I could take this.
Because I would presume most people know the anti-Zionist standpoint. You know, they're getting money from the United States, they're killing the Palestinians, they set up checkpoints, committing atrocities, UN war crimes, and la, la, la. And it's a blockade. Gaza's an open air prison. They're being oppressed. There's two forms of Israeli and Palestinian citizenship, and pregnant women are having to give birth before they get through checkpoints that take 4, 5, 8 hours or something like that. You know, the whole deal. Massive, massive, massive. Like, oh my God, they're terrible people. Mm. What's the counter argument?
And
more to the point, you know, because you can go through those elements. So Gaza is an open-air prison camp. What would you say to that?
Well, I will first qualify that by saying I have not personally been to Gaza. However, what I can say is this. Well, I'll ask you a kind of a rhetorical question. How many Palestinians have died of starvation since Israel took over Gaza from Egypt in 1967 and took over the West Bank from Jordan in 1967. How many Palestinians do you think have starved to death?
Don't know. I haven't seen the statistics on it.
Zero. So there's this notion that Israel is starving Gaza. Now, I'm certainly not about to go and say that the situation in Gaza is all hunky-dory by any stretch. However, a number of points have to be made. For a start, a lot of people have forgotten that in 2005, the Israeli military ethnically cleansed over 5,000, I think it was 8,000 Jews from Gaza. You heard me correctly. The Israeli military, the so-called Jewish army, ethnically cleansed around 5,000 to 8,000 Jews from Gaza. So there are no Jews living in Gaza. So it opens up a whole heap of questions of why the state of Israel did that.
They ethnically cleansed them. They actually killed them.
No, ethnic cleansing doesn't necessarily mean killing. No, they removed them by force. And as they didn't resist in any meaningful way, no, they were shot. I think most of the people who were cleansed, most of the Jews who were cleansed from Gaza are living at the fringes of Israeli society now, like living in poverty. That's a whole mess in itself. And a lot of their equipment, farming equipment and so on and so forth, of course, was left behind, and most of it was destroyed by the various so-called Palestinian militant factions or whatever. So Israel is not occupying Gaza. That's one thing that needs to be made clear. Another thing is, you go to the website GazaToday.com. I've forgotten whether there's a hyphen in between Gaza Today, but either way, it's a Palestinian website. It's a tourist website. It's advertising Gaza as a tourist spot. You can find on the web all sorts of pictures of an Olympic-sized swimming pool and shopping malls and the whole bit. Now, that in and of itself doesn't prove any, you know, doesn't prove a great deal, but it does show that, well, if it's an open-air prison camp run by the Israelis, then how the hell can they be building Olympic-sized swimming pools and shopping malls, and then there's pictures of markets, absolutely chockers full of food. Gaza is now essentially in the hands of Hamas, who's linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, and often Hamas is made out to be an adversary of Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority. And while I'm sure at the lower levels they are, the fact is that at the highest levels, officials from Hamas and Fatah will change places with each other and that sort of thing. Yeah, and if Gaza is this open-air prison camp, then how can it be that, you know, because you can certainly get, you know, YouTube videos out of there, you know, that there are a few of them on the web. You would think that you know, all this horrendous sort of thing would be available for the world to see, you know, via YouTube and so on. And also, there's numerous so-called, you know, international solidarity activists going there. Very strange thing. Like, you know, you'll often hear stories of what they call it, the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, sending activists, mainly from the United States and Britain, into areas where the Israeli military are, and on a few rare occasions, some of them have got killed in crossfires and that sort of thing. But what I would say is, well, hang on, what would be... Look, yeah, how many international solidarity movement type activists went and stood in front of any American tanks in Iraq, or would stand before American, or for that matter, Taliban troops in Afghanistan, or would go, like, what? How many war zones in the world can you go to as a political activist with minimal risk of being killed?
You know what? That's a very interesting question. I'd like to find out so I can go there, because my GoPro camera has an explosion-proof housing and I need to do some field tests. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Do you know whose side are you on? Welcome back, everybody. My very special guest... Nigel Waddington, we're talking about the very interesting situation in Israel, because technically Gaza and the West Bank and quote-unquote Palestine is Israel at the moment, according to all drawn maps and what have you anyway, and how there's basically, in my opinion, extremists and propagandists on both sides, so that nobody's getting the straight story from either side, so nobody knows really what's going on. What would you say to that, Nigel?
In essence, it's correct. Though the so-called extremists in Israel are a margin. Like, I mean, you will be able to find examples of very racist Jews, but they're marginal. The Israeli government, which is in control of the state of Israel, or reportedly in control, are essentially a bunch of globalist puppets who the main anti-Zionist line on the Israeli government suggests that, you know, this brutal imperialist colonialist type outpost. In actual fact, the Israeli government are facilitating what I believe the destruction of Israel. But perhaps it might be a good idea to discuss some of the historical context of the history of anti-Semitism and why it's there, because that confuses a lot of people too. Like, you'll often hear people saying things like, oh, the Jews have been kicked out of all these different countries, they must be doing something wrong, right? Well, no. I believe that the, you know, based on, you know, historical research, that the main reason there is anti-Semitism, the main reason why the Jewish people have been repeatedly attacked throughout history for the last 2,000 or so years, is because the Jewish movement, like, if you want to look at, I'm not talking so much about the religious side of it, but the how Jewish culture manifests itself politically, has traditionally been anti-tyrant. It has been a threat to tyranny. Like, the story of Moses and so on is the story of resistance and escape from a tyrannical pharaoh. Like, whether one believes the story is true or not doesn't really matter. That's the story. Right? Now, back in the days of the Roman Empire, when the Roman Empire, or the Greco-Roman Empire, I should say, was essentially in control in the Middle East and the Mediterranean, the Jewish movement was something of a political threat to them, because both Greece and ancient Greece and ancient Rome were essentially slave empires. They were built on enslaving people, and life for the average person in the Roman and Greek empires is pretty abysmal. And yet, some of the various peoples around the Mediterranean would be attending synagogues. I've forgotten what the name of them was. There was a special name for them. They were Gentiles, but they were allowed into synagogues to watch debates between rabbis and that sort of thing. And they would be getting the message that, hey, you're a human being. You have rights. You don't need to be treated like crap, basically. And this notion is becoming increasingly popular. And this became a threat to the Roman Empire. And ultimately, it culminated in the first genocide against the Jews in 70 AD, when the Romans destroyed their temple, killed huge amounts of them. Like, even though it wasn't in direct numbers the same amount as the Nazis, proportionally speaking, it was possibly even worse, considering that the Romans didn't have modern technology to carry out their extermination. And a lot of them were scattered throughout the world. So, there are Jewish communities in Europe and so on after that. And ever since then, what you could call the Greco-Roman elites, and I'm not necessarily talking about Greco-Roman elites literally, but tyrannical elites, found it to be in their interest to spread propaganda against the Jews, to convince ordinary Gentiles that the Jews were a threat in some sort of a way. They're poisoning the well. That was the story during the days of the Black Plague. The Jews are causing the plague. It becomes, they're running the banks, or they're doing this, or they're doing that. And that continues to this day. And what one of the questions people should ask themselves, because one of the ways I put it to people is, okay, let's just assume for a moment that Israel is the total bad guy in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Let's just pretend that for a moment. The fact is that compared to conflicts all over the world, the Arab-Israeli conflict has killed relatively few people, yet there's all this focus on it. Not only the mainstream media, but the alternative media, the United Nations. You'll get the so-called United Nations Human Rights Council, which is stacked full of the most tyrannical regimes.
Let's just compare this for a second. Let's just compare this to a second to Americans in Iraq. 1 million dead Iraqis, about a quarter of the babies are born deformed from depleted uranium. It's no fracking we're near that bad in Gaza, is it? There's not 33 people being killed in car bombs in a day?
Yeah, no. One thing that is important to remember, though, is that the US is no longer in Iraq. We can talk about the Iraq war.
Well, if you say so.
Yeah. Well, the occupation is officially over. The digressing a little bit, but essentially the main geopolitical function of the Iraq War was to convert Iraq into Iran's westernmost province. It wasn't about oil or the other line. Of course, the other line was, that they attacked Iraq because the evil Zionists infiltrating America forced us to get rid of one of their enemies for them, that sort of thing. But like you will notice that the majority of anti-Zionist themes are substantially similar to the propaganda that the Nazis were deploying against them. And the propaganda the Nazis were deploying against them basically comes out of essentially Vatican propaganda against the Jews. Hitler was saying that the Jews control the banks, right? So, hence, in the so-called truth movement, we hear all this stuff about, the Rothschilds, and there's a few, prominent Jewish bankers and so on that are wheeled out. Now, I would put on the table, I would chuck this on the table as a hypothesis that the globalist establishment quite deliberately has put in place certain
racial and religious archetypes so that they can garner support from whatever racial or religious archetype they want at any point. We've ticked off the people in Africa. Hey, well, conveniently, we have a massive banker from Zimbabwe here. Come on, Mugabe, put them all down for us.
Yeah, well, that sort of thing, yeah. But basically, the establishment, the core of it, is ideologically Greco-Roman. They would really love to have the world pretty much the way that the Greco-Roman Empire had it, so, of course, in a more modern context. Now, what happened is during the Enlightenment in Europe, which is where the tyrannical back of the Roman Catholic Church was broken, or at least the process of breaking it began, was the result of a guy called Baruch Spinoza in Holland, who was translating the works of, taking the works of a guy called Maimonides, who lived in, I think, 12th century Spain, and putting his themes, his notions of justice and civil rights, and to coin a cliche, all those other things, in a way that aristocratic members, European aristocrats, Christian aristocrats, could understand and accept. And so as a result, you get what's called Western civilization. Now, by Western civilization, a lot of people will then equate that with things like McDonald's and consumerism and so on and so forth. What I would say is that's not really what it's about. That in spite of the numerous problems we have in the West, I'm not going to say that the West is perfect by any stretch. Otherwise, there'd be no need for a so-called truth movement. Hey. But the fact is, certain notions, such as equality before the law, civil rights, and so on, are entrenched now in Western culture, to the point now that the elites are forced to either try and undercut them or to make a mockery of them. In fact, I think consumerism is part of making a mockery of those very important themes. Sounds like we're going to another ad.
Yes, we are. Ladies and gentlemen, Nigel Waddington is my guest also for the second hour, and we're going to divulge further into the details. Now, the very first conversation I had with Nigel wasn't under such amicable circumstances, but I came round and got to listen to the man and just go, like, you know what? He's right. Isn't that very interesting? I never knew any of this stuff. And I'm sure most of the people listening, it's the same for you too. And if it riles you up and it kind of gets you angry or something, don't worry. Just because you're kind of starting to realise that you might have been deceived all these years. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieexpertshow.com.